Today is Friday, May 31st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump's outrage over Thursday's statement by Special Counsel Robert Mueller continues.
There's no obstruction, there's no collusion, there's no nothing.
Major fallout over White House emails ordering the Navy ship USS John McCain in Japan to cover up its name. Also ahead, an iconic American musician has died. It's all on today's International Edition. Acting U.S. Defense Secretary Pat Shanahan said Thursday he did not authorize and was not aware of a White House directive to have the U.S. Navy ship warship USS John S. McCain out of sight when President Trump visited Japan.
I would never dishonor the memory of a great American patriot like Senator McCain. I also think it's important I'd never disrespect the young men and women that crew that ship.
During a visit to Indonesia earlier, Shanahan told reporter he is asking his chief of staff to look into the matter. An email seen by VOA shows discussions about the USS John S. McCain between the White House military office and an officer with the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet ahead of Trump's trip. Back at the White House Thursday, Trump later told reporters that whoever was involved in the move was well-meaning, but that he was unaware of the decision to hide the warship.
John McCain, I wasn't a fan, but I would never do a thing like that. Now, somebody did it because they thought I didn't like him, okay? And they were well-meaning, I will say. I didn't know anything about it. I would never have done that.
The Wall Street Journal first reported the directive to hide the USS John S. McCain from Trump. He frequently had feuded with the longtime Republican senator who died last year. The USS McCain was originally named for the senator's father and grandfather, both Navy admirals, and now honors all three men. Senator McCain's daughter, Megan, called Trump a child who is deeply threatened by the greatness of her father.
It's impossible to go through the grief process when my father, who's been dead 10 months, is constantly in the news cycle because the president is so obsessed with the fact that he's never going to be a great man like he was.
Media outlets report that a tarp was used to obscure the ship's name ahead of Trump's stop. Well, President Trump angrily assailed Special Counsel Robert Mueller's motives Thursday, a day after Mueller bluntly rebuffed Trump's repeated claims that the Russia investigation had cleared him of committing a federal crime of obstruction of justice. Mueller said Wednesday that charging Trump with any crime in court was, quote, not an option because of federal rules. But he used his first public remarks on the Russia investigation to emphasize that he did not exonerate the president. But the statement seemed to embolden Democratic calls for more investigations of Trump and possibly his impeachment.
I don't think so, because there was no crime. You know, it's high crimes and not with or. It's high crimes and misdemeanors. There was no high crime and there was no misdemeanor. So how do you impeach based on that?
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Congress is looking into all the facts and will continue investigating with nothing, including impeachment, off the table.
He also was clear in saying that if he thought the president could be cleared, he would have cleared him, but he didn't. And that is very clear. So he has given us an array of facts, which we will take to the Congress and to the courts as we go forward, as we investigate and litigate.
My colleague Steve Miller talked about it with VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman, asking what Congress is likely to do next.
The reaction is predictably but not entirely partisan. For instance, one of President Trump's main allies on Capitol Hill, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, said the case is over and that Robert Mueller is moving on into private life and it's time for Congress to do the same. So he was not moved by anything that Robert Mueller said. On the other hand, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, says it now falls on Congress to respond to the crimes, lies, and other wrongdoings of President Trump. Adam Schiff, chairman of House Intelligence Committee, said that Robert Mueller has one more service to provide: testimony before Congress and the American people. I do want to point out one interesting exception to this partisan trend.
Okay.
There is a Republican congressman from Michigan, Justin Amash, and he has been saying for some time now that there is something to be investigated and potentially to impeach when it comes to President Trump. And yesterday he tweeted, after Mueller's statement, that the ball is in our court, in Congress's court, meaning it is up to Congress to further pursue this matter.
As you mentioned, Democrats are speaking up and saying that perhaps it is time to pursue impeachment proceedings, not so much draw up articles of impeachment. Republicans are saying no, case closed. Is there any indication that that process is gaining momentum to a palpable pace, that things are going to move forward at this stage?
Let me tell you that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has a headache right now. She has been saying, let's not move to impeachment yet. Let's continue to investigate, maybe impeachment somewhere down the line. As the House Speaker, she does not want to get ahead of the American public on this. We have to remember that Bill Clinton was impeached, and his approval numbers actually rose after the impeachment, and House Republicans were punished for what they did in terms of impeachment. Nancy Pelosi does not want that to happen to Democrats this time around. If there is a call for impeachment, she wants the House Democrats to move in lockstep with American public opinion. And right now, the American public is not clamoring for President Trump's impeachment. So there is this scene that you see of Pelosi trying to keep her members in line. That job just got a lot more difficult because the calls for impeachment are becoming much louder among all Democrats on Capitol Hill right now.
And then you have the extra headache of, yes, the Democrats control the House where the impeachment articles are drawn up, but the Senate is where the trial takes place, and that's still Republican-held, at least until 2020.
Let's remember here that impeachment does not mean removal from office. Bill Clinton was impeached. He was not removed from office because he was not convicted by the Senate. What is impeachment? It is effectively an indictment, a formal leveling of charges by Congress. That in and of itself does not remove a president from office. The Senate could do that if they convicted a president on charges. This is a Republican-led Senate. I would say that the likelihood of this Senate convicting President Donald Trump are close to zero, if not zero.
All right. That is VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with VOA International Edition Steve Miller. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Hopes rise on averting a Turkish-U.S. crisis over Russian missiles. Trump advisor John Bolton says Iranian threat persists despite U.S. actions. A deadly blast rocks Iraq's Kirkuk region. And the U.S. reports the most measles cases in 25 years. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Israel's parliament voted Thursday to dissolve itself and hold an unprecedented second snap election this year after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu failed to form a new coalition government. Netanyahu had a Wednesday deadline to form a new government after winning the April 9th election. He was hoping to form the coalition between his conservative Likud party and ultra-Orthodox lawmakers and another conservative bloc led by former Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
The Knesset, Israel's parliament, voted for new elections in September after Netanyahu failed to form a coalition government amid infighting and high demands from smaller parties. Netanyahu, a right-wing conservative who has been in power for a decade, is furious. The developments are a shock because two elections in the same year are unprecedented, even in Israel's volatile political landscape. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Well, joining us now to talk more about what this all means going forward is Rabbi Terry Bookman. He is the author of the new book, Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. What is the latest on all of this and beyond going forward?
We could not form a coalition, and instead of allowing President Rivlin to ask somebody else to create a coalition, which is the right of the president, he quickly disbanded parliament, got the votes for that. So basically, there's no Knesset, right? Just the prime minister.
First of all, what exactly does a coalition in Israel mean? Is that sort of like their government, their parliament?
So, you know, in the United States, we have a winner-take-all election. Parties run against each other. Whoever gets the most votes in the Electoral College wins. In Israel, it's a parliamentary system in which it's never happened in the history of Israel that any one party has a majority in the Knesset. Knesset has 120 seats, so you need at least 61 seats in order to rule, based on the British system. No one has ever had 61 seats in the history of Israel, so every leading party, so the one who got the most votes, is asked to form a coalition with other smaller parties so that they can then create a majority and able to rule the government. This is the first time a winner of the general election was not able to form a coalition. First time in the history of Israel. So we're on new territory here. This time, Likud, Bibi Netanyahu's party, got 35 votes, and then the centrist party, led by Gantz and Lapid, also got 35 votes.
Mm-hmm.
And since the Likud and Netanyahu had been the prime minister, the president asked him, gave him the right to form the coalition. He has to form that with smaller parties, and that's a political wrangling kind of thing, because each party wants something in order to be part of the government. Usually they want some minister positions, and then it's a back and forth, backroom kind of haggling until they say yes. What happened this particular time, he had his coalition partners, one of which was the ultra-Orthodox, and then one ultra-nationalist group. The ultra-nationalist groups are secular, and they want a law to be in place whereas yeshiva students, Orthodox yeshiva students, are conscripted into the army. The Orthodox Party wanted that limited to a very small number. They could not agree, and they decided not to join the government. And although Netanyahu floated with the Labor Party, which left of center, that he would give them some ministerial positions if they would support the new immunity law, which would prevent the government, the Attorney General, from filing charges against them. They wouldn't sign on to that, so he couldn't form the government.
So obviously Netanyahu's obviously in a weakened position. Where does that leave him, and where does that leave the government of Israel, you know, overall?
He certainly has taken a big hit on this, and whether or not he can recover, I mean, he's like a zombie. He keeps on pinning away to recover and come back to life. He's had a long career doing that. Whether or not he can sustain this and survive this is anybody's guess. But for the next 161 days or so, Israel is basically without a government. They have a prime minister, and no laws are going to be passed, and there's no parliament. It's been disbanded. You know, governments should function. I mean, even if they are not great, it's important that they stay in power. And now with the American delegation in Israel, what do? They're talking to a prime minister who may not be the prime minister in 3 months from now. It weakens the possibility of them bringing any kind of viable peace deal, which didn't seem that possible to begin with. Now it makes it even more in jeopardy.
That's Rabbi Terry Bookman, author of the new book, Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. On June 4th, 1989, a bloody crackdown by the Chinese government on a student-led pro-democracy movement in China shocked the world. 30 years later, student leaders and activists of the movement attended a recent conference in a Washington, D.C. suburb where they talked about what happened in Beijing's Tiananmen Square and why. VOA's Anna Cook has this report.
On the night of June 3, 1989, crowds gathered on Tiananmen Square in the center of Beijing. Among them was Yan Jiaqi, then director of the Political Research Institute of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences.
Later, I realized at that moment shots had already been fired, but the hundreds of thousands of people at Tiananmen Square didn't see what was coming at them.
Armed troops and military vehicles advanced toward the protesters on Tiananmen Square from different directions outside the city. Those in the square had no idea what was approaching them. And around midnight, Yan returned home.
As I fell asleep around 1 or 2 a.m., I suddenly heard loud gunshots that sounded just like firecrackers, but the sound was much louder and sharper. We ran toward the balcony to take a look. Our balcony was on the east side of the alley where you could see East Chang'an Street. We saw a lot of flashes, intense ones. At that time, I knew they had opened fire, and I thought China had really changed.
That evening, along dimly lit streets, journalist Wang Juntao watched soldiers fire relentlessly on the crowd.
People attacked a few vehicles with bricks, marching forward, screaming, one, two, three. They stood together. Those bricks struck like raindrops. And as the bricks were thrown, the soldiers continued to fire.
Wang, who spoke recently at a forum in a Washington suburb along with other Tiananmen survivors, said some memories are still vivid 30 years later.
I saw for the first time a human die with eyes still wide open. His face was looking up at the sky, and his head was streaming down with blood. My head felt numb. It occurred to me that day was going to remain as a solemn day in China's history. China's politics was taking a huge step backwards.
On the night of June 3rd, when Peking University student Wang Dan heard that troops had opened fire, his initial reaction was disbelief.
From payphones on Chang'an Street, students called each other to spread the news that the government troops had opened fire at protesters. When the calls first came in, I still didn't believe what was said. But later, as calls increased, I realized it must be true. For 2 or 3 days, I had absolutely no thoughts because, you know, your brain turns numb with big shocks.
Looking back at Tiananmen, Su Xiaokang, who is now living in exile in the U.S., says the fallout from Tiananmen among China's leaders shaped the country's politics in the years that followed. A small faction of hardliners took power, he said, and have kept it, handing it off to their children, who are known as princelings.
The current political and economic systems were formed as princelings came to power. All of China's assets are in the hands of 200 families, which has led to their economic development at the total cost of the environment.
Yan Jiaqi says the government's inability to own up to what happened that night continues to hold the country back.
What happened on June 4th, 1989 needs to be corrected to all of China as a massacre, an act of crime on the people executed by the Communist Party. China as a country will never move forward if the truth about June 4th, 1989 is not told. Without justice, China will have no future.
Talk of Tiananmen remains heavily censored in China, where the bloody crackdown is still referred to by the government as a counter-revolutionary riot. For Xiaoyu and Hailun, this is Anna Cook, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International. Oh, excuse me, we have one more story before we take a break. What does a digital conference in France have to do with the Democratic Republic of Congo and its new president? Reporter Amy Gutman joins us now for details. So, Amy, I know you were in Paris last week. You were attending an event where a delegation from the DRC, government representatives, and also from the private sector were there. What exactly was going on? Why were they there?
Well, this was really interesting. I was attending VivaTech, which is held every year in Paris. This is one of Europe's largest tech conferences. Just to give you an idea, the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, actually opened the conference. Usain Bolt, the sprinter, was there. This was a big deal. So I was a bit surprised to see a stand that was manned by government reps and members of the private sector representing the Democratic Republic of Congo. They were there to promote the new president of the Congo, Felix Tshisekedi. They were there to promote his new digitization plan for the DRC.
So, Amy, with a new president after all those years with an autocratic leader, why is this now the priority?
You're right. After 18 years under Joseph Kabila, and he finally stepped down in January, many have a sort of cautious optimism about the new president, Felix Tshisekedi. He does have digital ambitions. Now, one could wonder why, in a country that's been ravaged by war and starvation and violence and corruption and total instability, not just domestically, but in the region. Why would digitizing the country be one of the first priorities? The reason why it's one of the first priorities is because the president has recognized that in order to turn the country around and in order to help the economy and create a self-sufficient society, he's got to create jobs. And so one of the ways that he believes he can do that is by empowering the Congolese people to try to solve their own problems by coming up with digital solutions and even offline solutions. So, for example, there was the first startup weekend was held back in April, and that was actually held by a group of European expats living in the Congo, and they've organized something called Kinshasa Digital, and it's a new incubator. So during that startup weekend, they invited young people, well, actually people of all ages who wanted to start a business, who wanted to become entrepreneurs and maybe had zero experience. And from that group, they awarded the prize to a group of people who had come up with an offline solution for alerting communities to Ebola risk. This is a perfect example of people solving their own problems. So the belief is that if they can create infrastructure. And to be fair, the president's small team, which are now part of his cabinet, this is a team he's appointed to help execute his plans. They're aware of the challenges that exist, and they're very upfront about the fact that they currently don't have much of an infrastructure for small businesses to be established and thrive. They know they need an internationally recognized legal framework. They also know that if you create these things, it's more likely that you'll be able to attract foreign investment, even if that's somebody such as Google coming in and wanting to lay cables for broadband. At the moment, some of the challenges go beyond the access for businesses to exist and as basic as internet access. So the interesting thing about the DRC is that their digital penetration rate is a staggering 6%. That means just 6% of the population is connected to the internet. It's kind of unimaginable for those of us who don't live in that kind of environment.
Right.
And the reason why is because outside of the capital of Kinshasa, you have very rural areas. The other reason why is it's incredibly expensive to go online. It's about $100 a month for internet access in a place where people make about $1 a day. So you add to that the fact that just last year, 4.5 million Congolese people were fleeing their homes for neighboring countries. 2 million children were at risk of starvation. Online access was not a priority. Survival was a priority. So the idea here is to use this as part of a multi-pronged approach to try to rebuild the country and become more self-sufficient.
All right. That is Amy Gutman reporting from Paris. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Family, friends, colleagues, and fans of the late Kenyan literary icon and gay rights activist Binyavanga Wanyanya held an event in celebration of his life and works on Thursday. Binyavanga was one of Africa's celebrated writers who won the Keene Prize for African Writing in 2002. In 2014, he came out as gay when he published a lost chapter of his book on a South African blog, a chapter he titled, "Mum, I Am Homosexual." Binyavanga's death came days before a high court ruling that upheld Kenya's colonial-era law against gay sex. Raoul Ambour reports from Nairobi.
family and friends of Binyavanga Wainaina, the Kenyan literary icon who challenged stereotypes and prejudice through his writings, held a ceremony Thursday to celebrate his life and work. The attendees streamed into the intimate garden event as the sound of soft instrumental African music played in the background. James Wainaina, Binyavanga's elder brother, spoke to VOA.
How I'd like people to remember Binyavanga, I think, would be encapsulated by just a very brief thought. Ken's life was a seed, and he planted that seed not for himself, but for others, just listening to the number of artists who found their voice, because Ken believed in them, gave them a platform to speak in so many different fields, be it musically, very many different types of artistic expression. That's how I'd like him to be remembered. And that's what life is about.
Binyavanga won the Kane Prize for African Writing in 2002. He also founded the Kwani Trust, a publisher that championed African literature by promoting new writing. Billy Kahora, a writer and editor at Kwani Trust, worked with Binyavanga.
I think his legacy is so big that to try and capture it like in a moment, you'd actually have to meet him. You'd have to meet him and kind of spend 5 minutes just to get a sense of what he is like. But I think the other ways to meet him is through his writing. I think because he had so many facets.
Kenyan artist Sitawa Namwalie read one of Binyavanga's most consequential essays titled I Am Homosexual Mom, in which Binyavanga imagines what it would be like to come out to his late mother. A strong LGBTQ advocate, Binyavanga came out as gay through the essay in 2014 and revealed that he was HIV positive. For a conservative section of the society, being gay outweighed Binyavanga's life achievements, but Wainaina doesn't care.
The conversations, everyone has a right to speak. As far as I'm concerned, Ken was an amazing guy. I love him dearly, and nothing anyone says would make me change that.
Kwani Trust is now working on a project to immortalize some of Binyavanga's works.
Some of his work has been put together on a website called planetbinya.org, but I think like kind of formalizing this in a kind of formal reader, this is an idea we are kind of playing around with, and this is kind of a collaboration between friends, family, and we'll obviously be discussing this after to just come up with concrete plans.
Kenneth Binyavanga was 48 years old. Rael Ombor, for VOA News, Nairobi.
Leon Redbone, the blues and jazz artist whose growly voice, Panama hat, and cultivated air of mystery made him seem like a character out of a ragtime era, has died. Redbone's career got an early boost in the early 70s when Bob Dylan met him at the Mariposa Folk Festival in Ontario, Canada, and praised his performance. He released his debut album on the track in 1975 and dropped 16 more albums throughout his career. Most often dressed in a white suit with a string tie, wearing glasses and a Panama hat, Redbone performed twice on Saturday Night Live in its first season, and was a frequent guest on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. Redbone retired from performing in 2015 because of unknown health issues. A 16-minute documentary about his life, aptly titled Please Don't Talk About Me When I'm Gone, was released last year. Show him my plea. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. It's an air wind that blows nobody good, blows nobody good, they say. If anybody knows, I certainly should. 'Cause it blew my gal away. That blew my gal away. I've had the blues all day. It's early morning. I'll be
This is VOA News. I'm